This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me well? Good. I thought today was really, and Nick, welcome. Good to see you. This morning we read Shantideva's The Benefits of Bodhicitta, and we had a really wonderful reflections, I thought, reflections and questions, really quite deep. And one thing that came up was aspiring, we touched on what Shantideva gives us, his view of the difference between aspiring bodhicitta and generating bodhicitta, which we will get into more throughout the week. But people remarked on that, and I thought this today after our meeting, I've been thinking how we have at Jikoji this wonderful example of both, and both together. Jikoji is just doing such an amazing job, everyone there, of holding this sesshin. They're really doing everything. They're being the tenzo, the doans, and it's more than usual than when we have an in-person sesshin. The actual activities get spread out a little more when we're in person. But now people are showing us bodhicitta at Jikoji. So thank you all for that. And I want to also thank those who are joining us on video, but who will be also generating and aspiring by helping out also the bells and go on service and various things. It's really wonderful to see. So I wanted to begin my remarks this afternoon by reading verse 2. Of an explanation of the benefits, which goes, there is nothing written here that has not been explained before, and I have no special skills in composition. My reason for writing this is to benefit others and to keep my mind acquainted. So that's, I didn't write this, but to even talk about it, I feel like I can understand what Shantideva is talking about. I have what he's writing in his verses. I have no special skills, and my reason for talking and being here is to benefit others and to keep my mind acquainted. Keeping our minds acquainted is I think one of the key maybe ways of looking into Shantideva's. He was this whole text, he's talking to himself and about what he recognizing in himself, what he wants to do, recognizing his aspiration and encouraging himself to keep on keeping on, to keep on doing this path of the Bodhisattva, which is a radical path. Like in the whole Buddhist undertaking is radical, but the way of the Bodhisattva is taking these vows that we take every time we do a sitting with a group, the Bodhisattva vows, which we will take again at the end of this talk. And discussion, they're really quite radical. And Shantideva's reminding himself and then through his work, us, that we don't want to become habituated. We don't want to just like be doing things by taking the vows by rote. And it's I don't know about you all, but it's easy to do that. Habit is a deep ingrained way that human beings are in the world. And it's part of our evolutionary heritage, like so much is. And so we can just slip into, you know, yes, well, I'm doing, yes, I'll just do the Bodhisattva vows without really letting the words sink in each time that we say them. I remember at one point I asked Angie, and she encouraged me to, I said, well, I have different, so other languages coming to me about these vows that we're taking, and I would like to, I'd just like to explore that. And she was very encouraging about that. She said, yes, you have to make them your own in whichever way you can. So that's one thing that people can do or do, actually. So I'd like to tell a few little stories today, and I will be telling others through the week of Shantideva's life. I'm not at all a Shantideva scholar, so I don't know a lot about his life, and others here might know much more, and I encourage you to share, or anything more, and I encourage you to share your stories if you have them. But I have picked up some stories here and there. I remember the very first time I read Shantideva was when I was practicing early Buddhism and insight practices, but I came across a book that had a kind of a compendium of Buddhist writings, and I was immediately struck by the verse where he says it is a jewel beyond measure, and it's in chapter 3, which Paula will be discussing with you on Monday. And it is a feast of joy to which all are invited. And that just went right in. Dogen went in the same way, like reading the Genjo Koan. I understood nothing. I was not practicing Zen for many years, but sometimes language can actually serve a useful function for us, even though language is tricky. So those things went right in. So when I began practicing Zen with Angie, I started to read Shantideva on my own. We didn't study it formally in the Floating Zendo like we did many other texts and sutras, but I talked to Angie about it, and she encouraged me to read it on my own. Occasionally we would have conversations about it. But it was scary. I mean, I went like, the first time I read it, it was like the whole thing years ago. I just went, oh, I don't know about this. Maybe I'll just keep saying the vows and hope for the best, because it's strong meat. It's really, there are a lot of things in here that he doesn't pull any, he doesn't sugarcoat things. And he uses a lot of warrior language, a lot of metaphors. So I back up a little bit. The whole of the Bodhisattva, Guide to the Bodhisattva Way, is written in poetry, quatrains, and composed spontaneously, apparently, according to stories. So some of these things are like stories, some are myths, some are, there's something known about Shantideva's life, certain historical facts, like there is about Buddha's life, but there's a lot of shading at certain points, which are the stories and which events might have actually happened. But the story is he composed this verse spontaneously, and all in poetry, the whole 155 or so pages, 10 chapters. The one chapter on wisdom breaks the mold of the quatrains a bit. And that's the really deep Nagarjuna-like philosophical section of the book, if you will, and we will be taking a brief glance at that toward the end of the week, or the end of next week. But it's quite remarkable even to think of whether he composed it all at once or not, that we have these verses that guide us. And what do they guide us toward? They guide us to a radical self-awareness and unselfishness, basically. I mean, that's just, and I'll probably be finding other ways to say that, but that to me is the kind of crystal, one of the really brilliant jewels in here that Shantideva understands for himself and tries to share with us what it really takes to unbind ourselves from ourselves. He uses language later on, and we'll get to those chapters of letting go of self-cherishing or exchanging self for other. So then how do we do that? That's what he's pointing to, and how we get there is through the paramitas. So the paramitas are, for such a powerful group of attributes and factors for awakening, enlightenment, for the Bodhisattva way, they don't have any real canonical status either in the Mahayana or the early Nikaya, the early text, or the commentaries from the Theravada. They were composed by people, monks, after the Buddha's enlightenment, but they're about being alive in relation to others. That's why they were composed, because people needed a way that wasn't rule-based, that you cannot do this or you cannot do that, but that pointed to how you could get along together. So the paramitas, which I'm a real fan of, and I'm happy to talk about a lot, because I feel like I need these pointers, these guidelines. Generosity, the whole of this book, the whole of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Path is generosity itself. And the first couple of chapters, three chapters particularly, you could point that out. And then we go through ethics, sila, morality, which are the precepts. Although he doesn't explicitly talk about the precepts, those are embedded in the chapters where he talks about ethics. And then patience. Patience is a really huge paramita. For me personally, and for many, many people, especially in our culture, which is quite an impatient culture. And then there's enthusiasm or zeal, or right in the translation I've chosen to have printed up for our work, partly because I think it is the best poetry. That's my opinion. It's called right. It's called effort, depending on effort. So effort, any one of those words. And then these are the Mahayana paramitas that Shantideva's putting together for us and giving us his remarkable insights into. So then after the effort, there is meditation, and then there is wisdom. So that's how he structures this, and that's what we'll be going through. So a little bit of the background of Shantideva. He was another one of those, apparently there were a number of those, like Buddha, who were born into princely or semi you know, pretty well-off families. Even Shantideva was supposed to be a prince, and then they got the calling somehow, or they knew what they knew they wanted to do something other than be a prince. Of course, by the time Shantideva came along in the 8th century Christian era, there were actual opportunities in the society of his time in northern India to actually do something. Whereas when Buddha got the calling or had the insight or woke to the fact that there's something more to life, that he had some sort of templates to follow, which he did, the wandering ascetics, but he didn't have the whole background that in Buddhism, or what came to be called Buddhism, that Shantideva did. So after Shantideva seemed to have bounced around to a lot of places, and he finally got into Nalanda, which was the great university in northern India at his time, that had 10,000 monks, or more or less that many, and the biggest library, they say, in the world at that time, anywhere, is what the claim that I have heard. And it's a really remarkable place. I was fortunate enough to go there on a Buddhist pilgrimage years ago. And even now, when it's been centuries later and destroyed by the Mughal Empire largely, or partially and largely, it's still a vast space with where monks live together, study together, etc. So Shantideva got in through a rigorous examination, which he barely got in, according to the story, but he did pass the examination and got in. And this was, it sounds like to me, from the stories I've heard, it sounds like stories I've heard from friends who are professors and in the academic world. It was like a very academic, competitive, and kind of mean environment to spend time in. And Shantideva had not an easy time there, not an easy time at all. So the monks made a lot of fun of him and played tricks on him, because he was known as somebody who, they called him, this was his nickname, and I got this from a Buddhist Tibetan teacher who I listened to give a talk on Shantideva. It called him Bu Ku Tsu, which is, or Bu Su Kus, which is eat, sleep, shit. That was his nickname. He was considered just, you know, you're not engaging, you're just slacking off, you're not doing well. So they were always playing tricks on him, and he would try to go out and into the forest surrounding and take his books and studies and kind of be by himself, but they would follow him and he'd fall asleep, and then they pour water over him or grab his robe, or you know, do mean things. So he had plenty of occasion to get angry, and that's another big theme of his, which is recognizing his own anger and how to deal with that, which is one of the major precepts in the Mahayana. And it's a deep human, it's one of the three characteristics. It's a deep human, deep-seated trait we have, anger. So he gives us a lot of insights into how that might be possible. So finally, as the story goes, they said, okay, well, we'll give you one more chance, the monks did, or something like that. And they said, all right, You've been studying, you tell us, and you've been doing things. So we invite you to give a talk. Share with us what you have, you know. And so they fully expected him to fall flat on his face because as far as they could see, he was doing nothing but eating, sleeping, and shitting. And that's so how easy it is to make these judgments of people based on partial observations. They said, okay, but we'll make a nice Dharma seat for you to give the talk. And so what they did was construct like a 2-story high Dharma seat, and then they took the ladder away and there was no way for him to get up. So the story goes that Manjushri appeared in a flash from above, reached up and brought the Dharma seat down to where Shantideva was. And he sat down and he reeled off the whole of the Bodhisattva's guy. So that's Shantideva. So sort of what I know about him, the stories I know about him. Or some of the stories. So in this first piece that we read aloud and had these beautiful contemplations and reflections on, I don't remember everyone's, but I do remember a lot of them, and they were very striking. And I'll mention a couple of those. But what we're discussing in this first view, the sort of Shantideva condensed, according to my view, in this first chapter, the benefits, intention, aspiration, and gratitude. Certainly Kathy called out gratitude. And intention was mentioned in a couple of different ways. Aspiration. First comes the aspiration, and then comes the generation, generating the bodhicitta. So I think it was Mike. I just heard his voice, but I believe it was Mike who said what... asked the question, I'm wondering, what is the source? What is the source of this aspiration? Well, I think each of us will have an answer to that, or maybe not. Maybe it's a koan for us. Maybe it'll always be a koan. But nevertheless, we know it. We do know it. That's why we're here. That's why we say these vows. So, and Tom brought in aspiring and generating, and how bodhicitta seems to come and go sometimes. It seems to have a wave-like pattern, perhaps. He didn't use those words, but... And I think Shantideva recognizes that in this chapter, that that's why we say the vows, because it does come and go, because we are in different states and different situations, and it's easier to recognize the bodhicitta sometimes. I think it's always there, but it's much easier to recognize and actually touch. So in other words, to touch our aspiration and then generate it in a given situation. Like when somebody's yelling at us, something, you know, it's an interesting path. And then, for the aspiring and engaging. Shantideva does make that distinction that they're that they are different, that aspiring is more about thinking about it or wishing it to be so, and but not actively doing it. So there is action. There is. So it kind of brings in the relative and the absolute, which is summed up in chapter 10, but or not summed up, but explored deeply. So that's what Shantideva actually says. The wise should understand the difference, just as the distinction between wishing to go is actually under, and going, and actually going is understood. So the wise understand the distinction between aspiring and acting and generating. So then intention, he goes on to say, whoever takes up the engaging mind of bodhicitta with the intention to never turn back from completely liberating. I remember Angie used to say, whenever we did the vows, not, or often if it would come up, somebody would ask, or like, well, what are we actually, when we say we're going to save all beings, what does that actually mean? You would say, well, you're saving the beings that are you. You're really saving all those beings within yourself. And I think that's what Shantideva is pointing to. They're, all these beings are within us, especially when he gets to the chapter of persevering and effort, dealing with our enemies or different ones. And keeping that intention to stay with it, even when it gets difficult. The chapter on right effort and perseverance. He ends by, well, his second to the last verse says, whoever generates a pure mind of faith, this is one of the benefits, but you have to generate it, the effects of good fortune will increase. Even when the bodhisattvas are faced with great adversity, negativity does not arise. Rather, their virtues naturally increase. So he presents us immediately with some interesting thoughts and insights, and then he proceeds to illustrate, unpack those for us as we go through. But that's a lot from me about Shantideva. So I'm very curious and happy to hear what you have to say about these verses we read today, or anything that comes up for you now. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
I sort of wish I had read this ahead of our meeting. Anyway, so it sounds like something I should pick up, especially that it is addressing recognizing anger and working with anger. It seems like a useful guide.
Thank you, Karen. It does. You ask a beautiful question this morning. You asked, I wonder what we're being asked to give up following this guide, following the Bodhisattva path. And what I feel Shantideva is telling us, we're asking to give up self-centeredness. Mm-hmm. That's the basic thing we're asked to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And also that includes our narratives, our stories, we're asked to give up ourselves, and then that opens us to seeing that we are everyone else and everyone else is us. That thing that's so hard to actually articulate or say in words, but that's so hard to feel. We can, when we're just caught in ourselves, when we're just caught in our small stories. So I think that's what he's pointing us to. And he has a lot of wonderful examples of how to do that through the paramitas. Thank you.
The story of Shantideva at Nalanda reminds me of when I was a kid, we were Catholic, and I read a children's or a young people's biography of Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas. And when he was in the seminary, they called him the dumb ox. And he later became, the smartest guy in the church, I guess. But it reminds me that. Also, underestimation.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Story, that memory. And I see Kavli wants to speak. What you just said, Tom, reminds me of something Kaveh said too this morning about how you didn't have to be a Buddhist or even religious, or you didn't even have to be a human being.
I probably misspoke. But
that's what you said this morning.
So I did say that. Yeah, I did say that.
What would you like to say now, Kaveh?
But what Tom said, that was also that story about, you put it very, very, how do you say it? Very straight, what they called him, Shantideva. But I always root for the underdog. I don't know why that is, but in the spiritual path, there's many examples of that. Huineng is one. He was illiterate. He was from poor family, and he wasn't even qualified to hear the teaching. He was just pounding rice. Suzuki Roshi was called Crooked Cucumber. No good. They called him, you'll never amount to anything. That's Suzuki Roshi. So it's like the princely path. I mean, I think, the Buddha was from the princely path. Maybe Shantideva, I don't know. There's example of priests that in generation and generation, they had their fathers were masters and so on. And then there is these meteors that come from nowhere. So that always touches me. And about what I said, I thought of what got into me to say that you don't even have to be human to be a bodhisattva. That goes against all Buddhist theory, you know. There's relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta and human life being precious and a rare opportunity, like a flash of lightning, and don't waste it and all that. But I really feel like beyond reason, without reason, maybe mistakenly so, that, you know, I've seen, observed in nature, animals have a lot of kindness and a lot of, we don't know, I don't know, and how to judge them. I've seen them do a lot less harm than a lot of humans, a lot more education. And in Buddhist canon, there is also the idea of transmigration or reincarnation. Even animals can become Buddhas later if they show some merit, which is interesting. So to me, that means they too can arise the mind of bodhicitta, the heart of bodhicitta. Otherwise, how would they go to the so-called higher realm? But anyway, that's a question. You can't correct me.
Thank you, Kaveh. It's an interesting question. I think it is. I think a modicum of agnostic is agnosticism is a good thing. And I questioning, which is kind of an agnosticism, not holding to a fixed view, not knowing. I imagined when you spoke that you were thinking of animals, and then where my mind went was thinking of Dogen and all sentient beings, you know, stones. We don't really know much. So there's also another thing that I'll be repeating a lot, I think, because one reason, just honestly, I need to hear myself say it, humility. Humility is a big theme in Shantideva, not knowing it all, not knowing it all. But Shantideva is speaking to humans. So without getting off into the canon and, you know, kind of this, that, or this is for us. We have to deal with our stuff. And yes, I know you can see animals, sometimes even not mammals. mammals, we share a lot of DNA and a lot of characteristics with. But I agree, it's humbling in a way. It's worth keeping in mind. Thank you. Kathy.
I'm backing Kaveh up. Having recently read The Overstory, which talks about communication at the root level between various organisms in the soil through fungi. And if fungi can be bodhisattvas to warn other plant life that there's something to pay attention to, then I suppose stones can as well. I think we just live in a very anthropocentric time where we just think we're so special. And I think what you said about not always getting your way or not always being the center of the earth is really true about our relationship to the biome, to everything. And I think it maybe even as human bodhisattvas, we can strive, whether it's possible or not, we can strive to take care of this Mother Earth and the creatures in it.
Thank you, Kathy. Pamela.
You mentioned Shantideva's feeling a calling, and I'm wondering if he says anything about his calling or if you've read anything elsewhere, but what brought him on this path?
So the metaphors he usually uses in the books, the translations that I've read are like the flash of lightning. Like he doesn't know, he doesn't question the mystery. It's sort of like, it's a bit like the, where is the source? That is a mystery. How does this arise? How does it arise in what Kaveh talked about, the Jataka tales, in an animal or an insect, or how does it arise in a human? He's, from my perspective, he's more concerned with action, with generative, with doing, with how to use it when it has arisen, how to nurture it, how to keep it, and how to make use of it to benefit other beings. He's not so interested in the text. And I, as I said, I'm not a scholar, so I haven't read a lot of biographies, just bits and pieces here and there. I don't know if there are biographies even, so I haven't read any biographies actually, but just talks that I've heard or articles and, you know, things like that. So I don't recall anyone that said this is how he came to this. It seemed pretty unclear. It was like a miraculous sort of event when all of a sudden he gave this talk, whether there was the throne of Manjushri or not. He did write this down and gave this as a talk. Apparently that part is true. So, but he's a person of kind of a let's do it kind of a guy.
I was just contrasting him to the Buddhist story, where there is this deep early loss that seems to me to suggest a very deep yearning to understand. So we don't know anything about Shantideva in terms of that.
I don't know anything, no. I've never come across anything that he had an early loss. There was always just kind of glossed over about the prince. He didn't have an easy life. He never was really accepted in a lot of places. So maybe that could certainly be. He didn't feel recognized or accepted. It's not like losing your mother, you know, but it can be, so that's also part of the Buddhist story, that suffering and facing our suffering is like, that's where we get the breakthroughs. And so he's very big on self-awareness. So, and recognizing, but then maybe that could beg the question, then how do we get to self-awareness? I mean, it's, some people never seem to from the outside take that up. But sorry, I don't have a really good answer for that, but thank you for asking the question. Tom.
Well, I just Googled him, Shantideva, this morning before we started, and I found, I think it was in like the Encyclopedia Britannica online, but supposedly there's a story. He was he felt very close to Manjushri Bodhisattva, and he was going to be made the king, I guess. Maybe his father died, I don't remember, but he was going to be made the king the next day, and he dreamt while the night before he was going to be made king, he dreamt that Manjushri told him that it wouldn't do him any good to be king, that he shouldn't do it. And so then he didn't. And then he took off and wandered in India and ended up at Nalanda University. So that's, I'm not sure I got it exactly right. And I'm not sure I was reading a site that's too authoritative, but that's what I read.
Thank you. I kind of, now that you've said that, I kind of remember that story, but it didn't seem, I don't know, it didn't come to mind, and it wouldn't really be it's another story about a dream. Or I think Ben, as had his hand up, and thank you, Ben, please.
All right, thank you. Very good talk. Thank you very much. This is not a fully formed thought, but I was just thinking about the contrast between the throne and the Tower of Babel. Like in both stories, a higher power, if you will, reaches out and sort of levels the playing field. And I think that's a really interesting, like, cultural, anthropological coming together of a lot of different sort of societies.
Thank you, Ben. What I hear you pointing to is that actually that part, it transcends this whatever it is that awakens this aspiration. It transcends. It appears in different cultural and histories and different places in human society. So it's very human. It's anyone can have it. I mean, that's what I heard. I hope that was getting to some of what you said.
Hi, Carolyn. I'm sorry. I was thinking about. Actually, I wasn't thinking about it. It just came up. Sometimes the relationship between adversity and the spiritual path, I've seen in people who've suffered a lot of adversity, it can go one of two different main ways. One is to become bitter and blame. And the other one is to feel connected to others who go through the same thing and have some kind of empathy and compassion. So in this way, this is the bodhicitta. As I understand, the second way is the bodhicitta mind or heart, the mind that turns the adversity towards wholesomeness, towards benevolence, towards good wishes, towards people. Because you've gone through it, you felt it. I'm not pointing to myself. I mean, like somebody like Shanti Deva, no good. Suzuki Roshi, he had a hard time passing his koans. You know, they passed his koans by mercy almost. So, and he has a talk in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that he says there's four kinds of horses. I won't go through it, but the worst kind of horse is the one that has to be beaten so hard that the whip gets to its bone before it turns around. He says, and the best kind of horse is the one that before the one who's riding the horse is thinking to hit the horse to make it go faster, it goes faster. So he says, when people hear this, we all want to be the best horse. That was definitely true of me. But then he turns around and says, but who do you think Buddha's mercy will be with? Which horse will have Buddha's mercy? And he says, sometimes the worst horse is the best horse. So like what appears one way in the mundane way is not necessarily the way it is. So this is like the thing that I was thinking about, adversity and how it can be turned into the path, like they say, you know, like it said.
Thank you. Jen?
What keeps coming to mind for me, and I had the image this morning when we were discussing the earlier passage. I think it's from the Sistine Chapel. It's a painting of a man reaching towards God, and the fingers are just that close, you know, and I think of that fine line between aspiring for something and then that little whatever, the spark of lightning or something that where you actually take action, and it's a really divine sort of action that just is completely aligned and just works somehow. And just that tiny little gap, you know, I've often wondered if, you know, that moment before that contact happens, what that's like. And then also too, the moment after it happens where there's nothing you can do about it. The choice has been made. And I'm just really grateful for this talk today and having the space to really be in between the gaps. So just want to say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. That's beautiful. And thank you for bringing in an image. And Shanti Deva, he's a poet, so he has many beautiful images, but that's often a way that these things are conveyed to us. We see something that just makes an impression. What you just said, and people here may have this experience. We can certainly point to others who have that experience. This gap where there's no gap of people who are not Buddhists and who don't have bodhicitta, but it points to where maybe that source is, that it's all deep within us. They jump into a freezing river in the Potomac when there's an airplane crash through the ice in January, and they pull out people, and they are just, you know, they're not trained Marines or anything. This one fellow I remember from years ago, he just did it. And there are lots of stories like that, that human beings just do it. And what I often wonder too, where what is that that they, and that's in a way that to me is also what related to what you said, that just the choice has been made, you just do it. So, I thank you. And I think it's time to take those vows.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.